Future Proof Extra from News Talk.
Now, as we ease out of lockdown, having survived and somewhat weathered the storm of a global pandemic, in this part of the world at least, you might be forgiven for thinking that we would all be lauding the scientists that have spearheaded the fight against this invisible foe. But of course, you don't need me to tell you that not everyone sees it that way. Why? And how can we convince people that science is to be trusted and indeed cherished? Well, in the middle of a global pandemic caused by a microorganism, you'd think that might be an easy task. Naomi Oreskes is a historian of science and author of Why Trust Science. She joins me now. Naomi, welcome to the program. If we've learned anything over the past while, it's that science is important. But it seems to me that there is an increasing skepticism towards all forms of authority that has come sort of in lockstep with the proliferation of the internet. And I'm wondering, the skepticism that we have towards science in the past particular 5 to 10 years, notably in the States, but also growing in some parts of Europe, is that due to the leveler that is the internet when it comes to accessing information?
Well, a lot of people have expressed that opinion, and clearly the role of the internet here is a complicated one. It is certainly much more easy for disinformation, lies, conspiracy theories to spread like wildfire in the world of social media. And we've certainly seen, and there have been studies that show this, that on Twitter, for example, mistruths, disinformation, and lies spread much more rapidly than factual information. And we even have some idea why that is. If I say something truthful and unsurprising, that doesn't capture a lot of attention, especially if it's very reasonable, if it's very moderate. But if I say something absolutely outrageous, that will capture people's attention, and many people will retweet it, even if they don't agree with it. They may, you know, you often see people with that disclaimer, RT doesn't mean endorsement. So there's a way in which lies and disinformation spread in social media that is definitely problematic. But that said, I don't think we can lay the blame on this only on social media. So there's a couple of things here I'd like to clarify, if I may.
Sure.
It's important for people to understand that there is not a global general crisis of trust in science. We often talk about that, but it's actually not the case. If you look at public opinion polls, I'm most familiar with the United States, but the evidence in Europe is similar. The vast majority of people still trust science, and they trust scientists much more than they trust politicians, business leaders, or I'm sorry to say for you, journalists.
Yeah.
This tells us that actually scientists are doing a lot right. And it's really important for us to keep that in mind, because if we misdiagnose the problem, then the solutions we apply won't work. But what we also know is that there has been an increase, a spread of what I like to call implicatory denial. That is to say, rejecting science when we don't like its implications. And that's the common thread in the COVID-19 situation, and also with other things that I've written about, like climate change denial or the rejection of evolutionary theory. These scientific findings have implications that some of us don't like. Like with COVID-19, the implication that we might lose our job, we might lose our livelihood, we might be stuck at home with screaming children, we might be stuck at home in a physically unsafe situation. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons why COVID-19 was a seriously bad news story. And so some of us, not all, not even the majority, but some of us, rather than accept that and try to deal with the consequences, especially if the consequences were unpleasant, you know, seriously unpleasant, which in many cases they are, we deny it. We say, I won't get sick. It won't affect me. You know, CDC can't even make up their minds about masks. So we create a justification in our own mind that allows us to reject the scientific evidence and keep doing what we want to do.
Well, there's more to it than that, though, isn't there? Because it's not just rejecting the science. We cherry pick the bits that suit us, right? I mean, even just yesterday, I saw an argument on Twitter where someone was quoting a doctor saying that, you know, that these kids need less school and more playtime. And at the exact same time on the television, there was a doctor saying the exact opposite, saying these kids need to be in school, they're going crazy. And so the problem is that there's always, you're right, when I said the internet, it's not just the internet, it's the media. I think of that old advice of, you know, how to stay healthy and be a normal weight. And it's the problem with eat less, exercise more is it never changes. So for news people and media people and for entertainment and content people, that's just boring. So hence you have, you know, articles about the lemon diet and saying, does it work or doesn't work? Everyone knows it doesn't work, but you can't write the same thing over and over again in a health magazine, right? And so it seems to me that when it comes to the science, people they can find scientists or experts or authorities who will come up with completely conflicting reports, and then they can choose to use those as their sort of a validation of their beliefs, and that's really problematic because you know they both can't be right.
Well, they might both be right. I mean, depending on the children, right? I mean, many times when we have problems where experts are disagreeing, actually, they are both right. There's a famous line in John Stuart Mill where he talks about disputes in which he says, in this particular case, both sides are right in what they affirm and wrong in what they deny. I find that line applies to incredible numbers of things in life. So in the case of children, I mean, they actually might be both be right. It might be that actually children do need more time outside in the fresh air and sunshine, and we have overdone the school books, the exams, the standardization, all of that. And yet at the same time, it might also be the case that right now in this moment, many children really need to go back to school. So, but I think what you said is right, that journalists to some extent drum up the conflict, because as you say, if we just say, you know what, guys, we know what it takes to eat right, eat lots of fresh fruits and vegetables, not too much meat, right? I mean, Jonathan Pollan totally got that right in his book about food, The Omnivore's Dilemma. So kudos to him. But often journalists do try to drum up conflict. And as you know better than I do, the old slogan in journalism, conflict makes copy.
Yeah.
But the other thing I wanted to point out about this, though, is what you started with when you said, well, it's not just that people reject the science, but that they pick and choose, they cherry pick. But I want to point out that picking and choosing is rejecting the science, because the most basic principle of science, and this is what I talk about in my book, Why Trust Science, is about the importance of attending to all of the evidence. You're not being scientific if you just say, oh, I'm only going to pay attention to this evidence because that's the evidence I like, or I'm only going to pay attention to this evidence because that was done by my laboratory. Mm. That's unscientific, right? Science is all about trying to bring together evidence from diverse lines of reasoning, hopefully diverse people, different laboratories, and trying to weigh the evidence and trying to make sense of the totality of the information that we have available to us. And very often that totality is confusing, and sometimes it does conflict. And almost all major scientific controversies that we can identify involve at least some element of this, where there's some evidence that seems to be pointing one way, but maybe there's some evidence that's pointing a different way. And sorting that out and reconciling it and figuring out why these things seem to be contradictory is really what scientific research is all about. So if somebody cherry picks, they are rejecting science. And I say that emphatically because, of course, this is one of the central tactics that is used by climate change deniers and was used by the tobacco industry before that. Cherry picking the data, taking something out of context in isolation and say, oh, but you know, you don't have to worry about smoking because not everyone who smokes dies from lung cancer, which is something that actually Vice President Mike Pence has said. Well, that's true. Actually, the majority of people who smoke don't die of lung cancer, but they may get emphysema, bronchitis, heart disease, blindness, pancreatic cancer. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So that kind of cherry picking is rejecting science.
Let's talk about the idea of science being a faith, and that it's something to believe in. And so people who believe in other things equate those two things. Is that one of the big arguments against science in the United States?
Not really. I mean, scientists that I know, and myself included, when I give public talks, when I first started doing this work on trust in science, I would begin with a discussion of this exact question and say, most scientists don't like to talk about belief. We don't say we believe in climate change, right? We say we accept the scientific evidence of climate change, because it is important to make the distinction. Science isn't really about belief, right? It's about questioning, asking questions, collecting data, and then coming to conclusions that are most consistent with the available data. And that means that scientists have to be open-minded, that everything we know is subject to change. Science is fallible. Philosophers have spent a lot of ink talking about fallibilism as an intellectual and epistemic principle. And we have to be open to the possibility that new evidence could lead us to change our minds. These are absolutely accepted things in science and history of science and philosophy of science. But as I like to point out, and many others have as well, just because we don't know everything doesn't mean we don't know anything. And if we have to make a decision on an important issue like acting on climate change, then the most sensible thing we can do in science, as in life, is to make a decision based on the best information we have right now. And the best information we have right now tells us the climate has already changed in very dramatic and dangerous ways, that the driving force of this, the primary driving force, is human activities, mostly burning fossil fuels and deforestation, that if humans had not become involved in the climate, probably the climate would actually be cooling right now. We have pretty good evidence that that's the case. And so, yes, there are things we don't know. There are uncertainties. There are things about which honest scientists may disagree. But that's not a reason to reject the scientific evidence, the knowledge that we have. And so, again, I would come back to the idea of knowledge, right? The whole point of science is to create knowledge. So it's not faith. It's not belief. It is subject to change. It's subject to growth. We think of the growth of scientific knowledge as a good thing, but that growth can only occur if we stay open-minded. The noxious thing that climate change deniers and tobacco industry executives do is to take that strength of science, that openness to new information, and to try to make it into a weakness and say, oh, but you don't know everything. You just admitted that you don't actually know why Aunt Rose didn't get cancer, even though she smoked like a chimney all her life, and to use that against science. And so that's the sort of noxious part of it. And that's why I get a little hot under the collar about these issues, because this is not a good faith principled conversation about knowledge and uncertainty. This is disinformation.
Yeah. And that sort of hazy, armed with a little knowledge, being dangerous sort of scenario that we see, you know, plays out across hundreds of different issues across social media. So people are probably familiar with the idea of a scientific method, but in your book, you kind of challenge our understanding of that a bit.
The central argument of the book, Why Trust Science, is that there is no one scientific method. And that actually comes as a shock to many people, because many people were taught in school that there is a scientific method. And many people even think they know what it is. They think it's the experimental method, where I have a theory, I make a prediction, and then I see if the prediction comes true. But what historians and philosophers have shown is that that actually doesn't work. And it doesn't work for a number of reasons, but the most important is that if I have a theory and I make a prediction and the prediction comes true, it doesn't actually prove that the theory is right. So we have many examples in the history of science where we make a prediction, but it turns out other theories could also have accounted for the same thing. So in other words, more than one theory can make the same prediction. So just because the prediction doesn't come true doesn't prove whether or not that theory is the right theory. And the converse is the case as well. Let's say I make a prediction and the prediction fails. That doesn't prove that my theory is wrong. And this is one of my favorite examples in the history of science because it's one of the clearest and most important. So when Copernicus first said that the Earth was actually moving, not standing still, that it was the Earth going around the sun rather than the other way around, one of the predictions of that theory was that, well, if the Earth is moving, we should be able to detect that motion. And one way we could detect it was through the phenomenon of stellar parallax, that the position of particular stars in the sky would look different in June than they would in December. And so scientists actually did that experiment. They looked for the stellar parallax and they didn't find it. And so by the hypothetical deductive model, the experimental method, what we often call the scientific method, by rights, people should have rejected the Copernican theory because it had failed that predictive test. Now, today we would say, no, the theory is correct. And we would say we know why it's correct. We would say, well, it turns out the universe is much, much bigger than people thought. And so therefore the parallax does exist, but it's very, 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 very tiny. And their instruments were not sensitive enough to detect it. It wasn't until the 1850s, the work of Sir William Herschel, that telescopes became sensitive enough to detect it. So the failure was really a failure of the test. It wasn't a failure of the theory. And this is where science gets really tough. This is why science is hard. Because if you do an experiment and the experiment fails, you don't know whether the problem is in the experiment or the theory. Now, of course, there are things you can do to try to sort that out. And so a lot of science is really about that kind of sorting. It's about, well, could we test this in a different way? Could we use a better instrument? Should we go back and rethink the theory? And that's where all the complication comes in. And that's why science is hard. It's also why it's interesting and fun, because it's not trivial. If it were just a sort of recipe that anyone could do, well, then we probably wouldn't be here talking about it today, and we certainly wouldn't have Nobel Prizes.
What about the sciences themselves? Are there some sciences more trustworthy than others? Like, is medicine and how people have practiced medicine and psychology, is some of that work really undoing and eroding faith in science in general? I'm talking about the reproducibility crisis within psychology, and also the huge number of medical papers that up until very recently were just over the line to be statistically relevant, and that being a sort of an indicator that not everything was as it seems, that both pharmaceutical companies but also medical scientists were perhaps guilty of picking the stuff that made their work publishable, which is important for their career and so on. Is there a science that is more trustworthy than another, do you think?
This is a great question, and it's a very important one. And there's no question in my mind that, first of all, science is diverse. What we call science covers an incredible variety of different things. And this is one of the reasons why the book begins with my central argument, which is that there is no scientific method singular. There are scientific methods. The different sciences are different. What I did when I was a working professional geologist is quite different than what someone in neuroscience might do, which is quite different than what someone in artificial intelligence might do. So science is diverse, and therefore it stands to reason that at any given moment in time, one science might be working better than another. We might be getting more robust answers in one area of science than another. And that strikes me as, that shouldn't really be shocking. I mean, like, if you're in film, you might acknowledge that there are a lot of different kinds of films. We call them all films, but some are a whole lot better than others. So I think the idea that science is diverse and some areas could be stronger than others really shouldn't be that controversial claim. The second part of it, though, has to do with perverse incentives. I think, and you alluded to this, we know that there are some perverse incentives in science, and the biggest perverse incentive is this pressure to publish rapidly. And that this pressure is felt most greatly in sciences that are highly competitive, which is usually sciences where there's a lot of money at stake. So things to do with testing new drugs, big pharma, sometimes things where people could be competing for a Nobel Prize, but usually the big money is as big as the Nobel Prize is. There's actually bigger money in pharma. So these highly competitive areas, cancer research, certain areas of biomedicine, I think do exacerbate the perverse incentives. And in my book,
I think there are those incentives, I think, across the board for people to get, you know, tenure. I mean, I've heard mathematicians in this country talk about, you know, the pressure on them to publish. And of course, it's not just to publish, but also to publish something that it adds to, you know, just publishing anything isn't quite good enough in some of these fields. You need to publish something that gets citations, that gets notice. And so that obviously has its own implications, too.
That's true, but I think that a lot of people have exaggerated that, and I'll say that for a couple of reasons. Well, first of all, it's important to recognize that the incentive structures are not the same in all different countries. So in the United Kingdom and Ireland, you have a research evaluation system that is tougher and, in my opinion, more punitive than the one we have here in the United States. So yes, there is pressure on people to publish, but I would resist the idea that just the fact of pressure alone is problematic. Science is competitive, that's true. And it can be tough and it can be mean. I mean, in my book, I actually talk about this, that one of the key things that scientists do is that they criticize each other quite severely at times, because that is the process of vetting claims. And so when I was younger, I used to think that scientists should be nicer to each other. And I still think we should be nice, you know, when we go out for a beer and stuff, when we go to the pub. But I actually think the toughness of the vetting process is part of what makes science work. And so I would be very reluctant to make any kind of claim that pressure in general is a problem. Yes, we have to publish. We have to get our results out. We have to defend our claims. That's how it is. It's tough. But, you know, I've climbed mountains. I've been to Everest Base Camp. That was tough, too. Tough isn't necessarily bad. The question is whether the incentives are perverse. And I think that's where we need to have a more refined conversation. I think there are perverse incentives in some areas of biomedicine. I think people have demonstrated problems in some areas of psychology. But I would be very cautious about overgeneralizing. And in the book, I actually give some examples of where people have overgeneralized in ways that are quite shocking and unscientific. So claims that some people have made about a kind of general crisis of replication in science with actually no evidence to support that. And it's kind of ironic that a person who's getting all, you know, getting hot under the collar about unreplicated results and evidence would then make a giant claim without evidence. So I just think we need to be pretty careful here. I think, as I just said, we know we definitely have some problems in some areas of science and they absolutely need to be cleaned up for sure. But I would resist the implication that just because there's problems in psychology, that there's necessarily problems in paleontology.
That's interesting to choose paleontology of all the fields. No. That's the one I get. That's the one I dig at the most. But I
challenge you to come up with some good replication crisis problems there. I mean, you might.
People who listen to this program would know. We often have people on, and one of my favorites was one paleontologist who was convinced that a find of an early hominid was actually Down syndrome. Child, and then the idea that this was a published paper that was then, it just seemed so, how can you not know which one of these? It seemed to sort of crush my belief in anything that was derived. But I'm always righted by the end of an interview with a paleontologist, but then I read stuff and my faith wavers again.
Well, again, don't use the word faith, but paleoanthropology, of course, has a specific problem of having very small numbers of very small sample sizes, very few. And so they have a very big challenge there in trying to interpolate from small numbers of materials. I was thinking of paleontology more in the Darwinian sense. And actually, since we are speaking to an Irish audience, I mean, one of my favorite things in the whole world is the Irish elk and the fantastic specimen at Trinity College in Dublin. So when I talk about paleontology, I'm thinking about all the fossil evidence of evolution and how much evidence we have to support the idea that species have changed over time. We still have arguments about extinction. There are still big questions in paleontology, but I don't think it's a science in crisis.
Let's talk a little bit finally about how we should approach new evidence or a magazine article we read. I'd love to give people some ability to be able to dissect it or be skeptical about what they read in a way that they feel is fair.
Yeah, that's a really great question. Well, the way I think about it is to come back to this notion of scientific knowledge as being based on bodies of evidence. No important thing in science has ever been established by just a single piece of evidence. And I've written a lot about the whole notion of a crucial experiment. I think we have a lot of evidence in the history of science to say that Bacon was basically wrong about crucial experiments. There are certain experiments that are very important. There are experiments that do a lot of work to persuade people of the truth of certain kinds of claims, but it's almost never the case that one experiment alone, one observation, one finding, or one scientific paper changes the scientific world. In hindsight, people sometimes make it seem that way. People will talk about, oh, Einstein's 1905 paper on relativity, but it's because they take the work out of context. They make it seem more singular than it actually is. And it's kind of a truism among historians that when we dig, when we start looking closely, we always find a more complicated story with more people, more experiments, more data, and more complications. And that's hard for us, because it makes it really hard for us to tell a good story. Because if we get on, like if I come on your show and I say, you ask me what's the answer, and I say, oh, it's complicated. Well, that doesn't tell anybody anything. That's not very informative. So part of our challenge is, out of all the complications, to distill some of the key findings or the key or interesting or exciting developments. And so for me, as a historian of science who's sort of taking a meta approach to try to understand science as an activity writ large, what I want to argue is that it's never just about one paper. And so when journalists run with it, like there's a new paper comes out and the journalists write a breathless article about, oh my God, this new paper shows X, that's almost always doing a disservice. And we've seen this in recent weeks with all of the papers that have been rushed to publication in recent weeks. And this is, well, we haven't really talked about the whole pressure of being in a pandemic situation, which I think is different from the usual routine of science. But, you know, if you rush to publication to talk about a particular individual paper without discussing the caveats, the limits, what was the sample size, yeah, you can give people the impression that scientists have all agreed on X. And then 3 weeks later, when a different paper comes out saying Y, then you can give people the impression that scientists don't know what the heck they're talking about. Mm. And that's a disservice. So finding some way to make it clear, yes, this could be important. We want to cover it because we think it's interesting and important, but we also want to put it in context.
Naomi Oreskes is author of Why Trust Science. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome. It's been fun talking with you.